Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood of CNBC, in for David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. World leaders convened at the G7 summit in France this week. With President Trump's trade war rattling the global economy, he signaled the possibility of a truce with China.
I think they want to make a deal. I'm not sure they have a choice. And I don't say that as a threat. I don't think they have a choice.
Former FBI Director James Comey is taking fire again. The Inspector General ripped his disclosure of memos about interactions with President Trump. Memos Comey believed documented attempts to obstruct his Russia investigation. NBC's Hallie Jackson reports.
The Justice Department's independent watchdog is blasting James Comey for setting a, quote, dangerous example by not safeguarding sensitive information during his time leading the FBI.
And Hurricane Dorian barrels toward the southeast. The storm's expected to hit Florida on Monday as a Category 4. Governor Ron DeSantis issued a state of emergency for all Florida counties yesterday.
Have your plan and make those preparations right now. And you have to assume that if you're affected by the storm, that you will lose power. So make accommodations.
Join us. What's moving your world this week? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us now from Washington is Karen Travers. She's ABC News White House correspondent and noted fan of the Philadelphia Eagles. Karen, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington is Laura Barone Lopez, national political reporter for Politico. Laura, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, John, Karen, and Laura.
Karen, let me start with you. The G7. Did anything come out of that, and what was the significance of the fact that you had the French president inviting the Iranian foreign minister in without telling the president of the United States beforehand?
Yeah, that was a very big twist in last week's G7 summit. But the president in that press conference, when he wrapped up his time in France, insisted that he knew about it and that he was okay with it. But that's not how it seemed when we first heard that the foreign minister was arriving. And this is Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, trying to navigate and negotiate, get the U.S. and Iran to a table and talk about a deal. He was very optimistic, John, that this could happen in the next couple of weeks. The president, of course, said, sure, he would do it if the conditions were right. The White House has always said he'd meet with anybody if it could produce a deal. But very quickly, I think it was even before the president landed back in Washington, Iran's president Rouhani was throwing cold water on this, saying that he's not going to participate in a photo op. Certainly a bit of a reference there to other world leaders who've met with the president and haven't actually developed or agreed on a deal. He said there would have to be lifting of sanctions before anything would actually happen of substance. He's not going to just show up and sit down with the president.
Karen, before the week was out, the president had canceled a trip to Poland in order to oversee preparation attempts for Hurricane Dorian. Talk about the significance of that move and what the president's doing, what the White House is doing.
This was not surprising at all, John. In fact, this trip was supposed to be two stops. Remember, the president was going to Poland for the anniversary ceremonies marking the start of World War II, and then he had tacked on a visit to Denmark. That trip got canceled because of the controversy over the president saying he did or did not want to buy Greenland. He wasn't happy with the leaders of Denmark. So the trip had already been shortened. And then when we started hearing the rumblings that this hurricane was going to be developing strength, that it was likely heading to the Florida coast, it wasn't surprising to anybody at the White House that the president would reconsider. So he says he will stay back. Vice President Pence will do the trip instead. And the president's actually going to be at Camp David for the weekend, monitoring the storm. He's done that in for several hurricanes in the past. This one, though, could be personal. You know, two different properties that President Trump owns could be in the path of Hurricane Dorian. You've got Doral National Golf Club down in Miami and, of course, Mar-a-Lago, which is on the coast up in Palm Beach.
Laura, we know that the handling of disaster events has been politically consequential for presidents in the past. Could it be for President Trump?
It could be. And you could even say that it potentially already has, you know, also put another piece of the U.S. that is potentially could potentially be impacted by the hurricane is Puerto Rico, and which is an island that has still not recovered, home to millions of American citizens, but has been treated by the administration and spoken about by the administration as though the people that live there are not American citizens.
Including an extraordinary Twitter attack by the president on the leadership of Puerto Rico this week.
Yes, that's correct, John. And you can see there's really no hiding it, the difference in the way the President Trump speaks about Puerto Rico versus the way he was talking about Florida this week, as you mentioned. When he tweeted about Puerto Rico, he couldn't stop himself from also attacking the San Juan mayor, someone who he considers a political opponent of him. They've clashed in the past when the last hurricane hit Puerto Rico, Hurricane Maria. And again, the island has still not fully recovered from that. And so when he tweeted about the island, he attacked her. And then there was a very different response as he's been tweeting about Florida, which was just a very straightforward tweet about be careful, make sure that you're taking necessary precautions as this hurricane approaches.
Jack Beatty, do you feel reassured as a citizen that the president's on the case of this hurricane and not traveling overseas? And specifically, what do you think he's doing? Is he getting briefings on this? And is he actually participating in the preparation? Or is this something that is decisions made by how it looks?
I expect the latter, that the appearances are all. Now, of course, it does involve him, and he does have these resorts there, as Karen said. And so he's apt to personalize it. And I expect we're going to see some of that when he even goes down in the aftermath and looks at he probably will look at his own property, I can expect, and you know, shows such sympathy as he's capable of towards others. But that's always flavored with a strong sympathy for himself.
The I want to go back to the G7 for a second. And in the Trump era, when this president does not seem to regard multilateral organizations, international institutions, the same way previous presidents have, is the G7 significant? Is it important anymore? Or at least while he's president? Jack?
Oh, well, you know, his performance there was, especially in the 68-minute press conference, seemed to sort of right the knee to the G7 as a credible organization. Jim Mattis, in his memoir, Aides and Friends, this is quoting The Atlantic, say he found the president to be of limited cognitive ability and of generally dubious character. Well, both traits were screamingly evident in that 68-minute presser, which was a farrago of falsity, fantasy, and sheer flapdoodle. The president repeating himself, the president...
It's pretty good alliteration there, Jack.
Well, you know, I'm trying to live... but it was a kind of farcical coda to what really people are calling a sort of G6 plus one, given the president's seeming indifference to what the agenda was, climate change. Emblematically, he didn't show up for a meeting on that with the planet burning.
So what you're saying is it was a farcical farrago of flapdoodle.
That's his presser was, and the other people were sort of stepping around the chaos machine we saw on display there.
All right. I want to go to one particular issue that came up at the G7 that I've got to say I found extraordinary. At a press conference on Monday, President Trump said he'd like to see Vladimir Putin invited back to make it the G8 again, ending Russia's banishment since its seizure of Crimea in 2014.
I think it would be better to have Russia inside the tent than outside the tent. Do we live either way? Yes, we live either way. Is it politically popular for me to say that? Possibly not. I think a lot of people would agree with me, frankly, but possibly not.
Karen, we've had a Russia investigation for the last couple of years that has raised the question of what, if anything, Russia has to influence the president to cause him to be extraordinarily deferential. Given that as a backdrop, why would he come out and do this publicly and try to suggest that he, in fact, is on the side of Vladimir Putin in this circumstance?
I don't think this was out of character for the president from what we've seen from him for the last 2.5 years. The president, even as the Russia investigation was ongoing, always said he wanted to make relations better with Russia, that it was in the U.S. interest for him to have a good relationship with Vladimir Putin. And he said it was the Russia investigation that was standing in his way from doing that. We've seen the president I was with him in Finland last year when the president seemed to accept Vladimir Putin's take on Russia's election interference. He's made statements like this for 2.5 years. Now saying that Russia should be allowed back into the G8 is the latest attempt by the president, I think, to use his global influence to bring Russia back into the conversation.
That just begging people to draw the connection that everyone's been speculating about?
Yes, it is. I mean, and a lot of people have. A lot of his critics have. I mean, Democrats, you know, will openly speculate about his connections with Putin and whether or not, you know, the president is potentially compromised. That's stuff that you hear from Democrats all the time. And so it's why you also have now a majority of House Democrats calling for impeachment after this Russia investigation, because they feel as though that, coupled with other actions by the president, means that he should be impeached. But again, there's no indication that they're going to go down that road.
Hold that thought. We're talking about the week in the news, and you can join the conversation. Which candidates do you have your eyes on in the narrowing Democratic presidential field? What do you make of the Inspector General's condemnation of former FBI Director James Comey's conduct? We're talking with Laura Barrón López, Karen Travers, and Jack Beatty. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. We're discussing the top stories this week out of Washington and beyond. You can join the conversation. Are you concerned about the Trump administration's latest rules for children born overseas or immigrants seeking medical care in the United States? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Karen Travers, the ABC News White House correspondent, Laura Barrón López, national political reporter for Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. I want to start by playing a bit of sound from a development in the 2020 Democratic presidential race this week, which is emblematic of the phase that we're entering. Here is New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand announcing the end of her race in a video she posted on social media.
After more than 8 incredible months, I'm ending my presidential campaign. I know this isn't the result we wanted. We wanted to win this race. But it's important to know when it's not your time and to know how you can best serve your community and country. I believe I can best serve by helping to unite us to beat Donald Trump in 2020.
Laura Barrón Lopez, why did that happen this week?
So Gillibrand didn't make the cutoff for the third debate, and she struggled to get higher than or to even get 2% in the polls, which is why she didn't make the cutoff. She's also struggled to raise the adequate amount of money to make certain cutoffs. And so it appeared as though even though some candidates who didn't make the next debate were likely to make the fourth debate, she wasn't one of those candidates. She was really struggling. And her campaign decided that this was the make or break moment. They went all in Iowa with, million-dollar ad buys, and it didn't cut it. It didn't work out. She wasn't able to see that bump in the polls that she desperately needed.
Are you saying that all those Facebook ads asking for a dollar and saying you could have a shot of liquor with Kirsten Gillibrand just didn't work?
No, they just didn't work. And they, also the millions that Tom Steyer has spent in ads didn't work either. He didn't make the third debate. But unlike Gillibrand, he is on track. He only needs one more poll, and the qualifications for the fourth debate don't change. So he's on track to make that October debate.
Jack, there's been a lot of criticism of how the DNC has handled this. Are you one of the critics, or do you think this is a reasonable set of criteria that they've adopted?
Well, when you look at the contribution criterion, 130,000 people in
unique donors,
a medley of states. Yeah, that's not a very that's not a very high bar. That's not a national candidate should be able to clear that. So once I saw that figure, I said, well, that seems sound. And
I'd say the same thing about 2%.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I mean, you think it's the Mendoza line in baseball, and there was a sort of posthumous quality about Gillibrand's candidacy, even when it was alive. I mean, she had a viral moment, the Political Reports, at a restaurant in Iowa, where she was talking, and a woman was walking past her in the direction of the salad bar, and the woman interrupted the speech by saying, "Sorry, I'm just trying to get some ranch." You got no respect out there on the trail.
Kirsten Gillibrand's obviously not the only one. We've had Seth Moulton drop out. We've had Eric Swalwell, John Hickenlooper. I expect we'll see more. And in fact, where we ended up is that your network, ABC, only has to fork over one night of primetime for this debate rather than two. Are you guys relieved about that?
Well, I think it's going to make for the showdowns, for the matchups that people have been looking for. Mm-hmm. When you do these debates over two different nights, it's a draw to see who gets on the stage on which night. And I think people want to see all of these top candidates finally go back and forth together in one place so that it's not Cory Booker or Kamala Harris talking about Joe Biden or talking about Elizabeth Warren with them not right there. They're all on the same stage. Now, it's still a large field that's going to be up there for the ABC News debate. So it's a lot to navigate, and you don't get a lot of time for each candidate in this format. But I think this is what Democratic voters, this is what party officials certainly have been looking for and why they wanted to start winnowing down the field at this time. The sense is after Labor Day, Americans start paying attention now. Everybody's on summer vacation. They're paying attention to their own lives. Now it's September. Now things will kick in earnest, and you want to see the real contenders.
But to ABC's credit, with 10 candidates on stage, all of them there at the same time, you guys mm-hmm. added an extra hour to the debate. I think that's something that will enhance the opportunity for Democratic voters to hear more back and forth mm-hmm. than they might have expected.
And people want to hear more from these candidates because you want to see them going back and forth. And there's a lot of topics still to get into. They've had a series of debates now. They're obviously out there on the campaign trail, but there's still quite a lot to get to when you're putting them in one place and having them go head to head. I think just getting back to the Kirsten Gillibrand, and you mentioned the other candidates dropping out. I think it's notable, too, that the president is clearly paying attention to this. He tweeted somewhat sarcastically the other day that glad that people didn't find out that it was Gillibrand that he was really afraid of. I think we're going to see messages like this as each candidate leaves the stage and heads back to their day job. The president will weigh in with something, but he is paying very close attention to this. He was watching the debates when we were in Asia earlier this summer. So certainly he has his eye on this smaller field.
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Sakna on the line from Yarmouth, Maine. Sakna, welcome to On Point. What's your question?
Hi. It's not actually a question. We've got to stop focusing on each individual and the horse race and the popularity contest. We need to focus on our electoral process. It's so broken. We have this winner-take-all two-party system, and it ends up with total polarization in the way the negative campaigning is going, and people get so excited about which person. We need to have ranked choice voting nationwide. We just started that in Maine. It reduces polarization. It widens the field so that you don't get narrowed down to the least of two evils. We need to look at the Electoral College. Why do we have a system where time and time again, the people elected don't have the majority vote? We need to change that and stop distracting people with all this fun, oh boy, is he better? Is she better? People are like magpies. They'll look at that. But what we really need to look at is our process.
Sakna, thanks so much for your call. Let me turn to Laura. Laura, first of all, are people like magpies? And second of all, do you think that either of these possibilities, that is ranked choice voting, which Maine has adopted, or some structural reform to our election system like a change in the Electoral College, are those feasible?
Right. Well, ranked choice voting, I think, you know, a number of states have explored that in various capacities, and I think they'll continue to do that. Electoral College is really one of the big things that has come up a lot during the Democratic primary, whether or not a candidate support, you know, doing away with it, changing it. So that way, yes, that whoever wins the popular vote would actually win the election. And there are a number of candidates who support it. People like Joe Biden don't necessarily.
Requires a constitutional amendment, right?
Right, exactly. And so, you know, there's other more progressive candidates who say that they're open to it. They're open to looking at it. But again, that, you know, for a while, it seemed like it was becoming a bit of a litmus test. And now it hasn't been discussed as much. It's not necessarily the strongest line of attack that candidates are using. They're more differentiating themselves when it comes to healthcare or other issues that they think are more front and center with voters.
Jack Beatty, Laura ducked the magpie question, but do you want to either take that one or talk about electoral reform?
Well, electoral reform, if I'm not mistaken, and I could be, Maine just recently turned down a significant reform, which was to have their congressional districts and their legislative districts determined by an independent commission. Uh-huh. So it wasn't a great advance there for electoral reform. And, you know, people say forever say, oh, don't pay attention to the horse race. Look at the big picture. Well, eventually, the horse race is the big picture. Maybe we're just getting ahead of it now. It's true there are these big structural issues, and one thing is for sure. There was a Nate Cohn analysis in the Times a while back that really got people's attention. It basically was saying Trump could lose by, I think the figure was, 5 million this time and still win the popular vote. And he mapped out how it could happen. It all comes down to Wisconsin. And Democrats quoted after that were saying, if this happens again, we are going to attack that electoral. That's going to be business number one for the Democratic Party, abolishing the Electoral College.
All right, Karen, let me just, before we turn to other topics, get your take on 2020 and the little yo-yo effect we had this week when we had one poll by Monmouth University that showed Joe Biden having dropped, and then end of the week, Quinnipiac and Suffolk come out with polls showing him stable at 32%, mm-hmm. double-digit lead. Is Joe Biden a solid front runner in this race?
I mean, I think he's been the consistent front runner. I think if you look at where the race is right now as we head into the last weekend of summer, it's really no different than where it was at the beginning of the summer. He still has that double-digit lead in most polls. And then the question is, who's coming in second, third, and fourth, and by what amount? You know, how are they fighting each other for 2 or 3 percentage points? Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, you know, and then down the list. So I think that's been striking to see through all the campaigning and all the stops and the Iowa State Fair and everything that we saw the candidates do over the summer, we're still effectively in the same place we were before. And that's good news for Joe Biden. You know, they're trying to target where they have him campaigning, not having him do the same amount of events as other candidates. He's not blitzing the trail like others, but slow and steady seems to be working for him right now.
He's got 3 hours on the ABC debate stage ahead of him. Let's shift gears, because the administration this week has taken a series of actions to vindicate its what President Trump calls its America First agenda, one of which was a change in the way the United States regards children of U.S. service members born overseas and whether they're automatically considered citizens, whether they have to apply. Will Godwin, a U.S. Army veteran and director of government relations at the Liberal Veterans Advocacy Group, Vote Vets, condemned the Trump administration's new policy in an appearance on CNN yesterday.
Having served alongside immigrants who felt that patriotic call to serve, it's a total insult to their service. You know, they love this country so much that they would risk everything. A lot of them not even citizens themselves yet. And so to say that we're just going to put their family in political crosshairs and treat them in such a disrespectful way is unacceptable, and it tears at the fabric of our military.
Karen Travers, why is the administration taking this step? And it seems so potentially unpopular, given the fact we're talking about the children of service members.
Well, administration officials were acknowledging, I should say White House officials acknowledging, that the rollout of this new policy did not go well, that they did not handle it in a way that effectively said what they wanted to do. There was a lot of confusion. There was a lot of fear with the headlines that came out. But administration officials, even as they struggled to explain what's going to happen, were insisting that this is very narrow, that a very small number of people every year would actually be impacted by this. This isn't a wholesale change in policy. That didn't stop critics from saying that this is, you know, an attack by the Trump administration on military families. But I think when you look at it, they say that certain families would be impacted, people who don't meet certain residency requirements while living or serving overseas. And if you're adopting a child born outside of this country, you would be applying for citizenship, but that this isn't changing that birthright. If you are serving in the military and you have a child while you're living there, this doesn't negate that. It just adds potentially a step for some families. Again, though, they're trying to say it's only maybe 24 people a year. That's certainly not how this was first received, and that's not how the headlines were framing it.
So that's one piece of the agenda that we were talking about this week. Another had to do with how immigrants who are not American citizens but are gravely ill are treated by under our laws on deportation. 16-year-old Jonathan Sanchez, for example, was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis as a baby. He told WBUR Shannon Dooling he fears that the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service will deport him to Honduras, the country where he was born, because of the agency's announcement that it will not consider deferrals for serious medical conditions.
If they deny the program, that I need to go back to my country, and I'll probably die. Because in my country, there is no treatment for CF. Doctors don't even know what's the disease. The only ones who can help me are here in the United States.
Laura Barrón-López, how could a policy of this kind be anything other than a political disaster?
Well, I think that when you take this in the bigger picture, it fits with what the administration's, motives are, which is to dramatically change not just immigration law for undocumented immigrants, but also immigration, legal immigration rules. And so, you know, what was also stunning about this announcement was that, well, there wasn't even a public announcement. It was just a change that was made, eliminating the deferred action program, you know, allowing immigrants to avoid deportation when they're undergoing life-saving medical treatment. And the U.S. receives about 1,000 deferred action applications related to medical issues each year. And so when you look at the bigger picture, this administration is dramatically, in very little ways, but systematic ways, changing the immigration rules of the country. On top of this, you know, the LA Times had this stunning report about the administration's Remain in Mexico protocol, which is having really devastating impacts on families, potentially fatal impacts. And the report, what was so stunning about it was that it found that the U.S. administration has pushed some 35,000 asylum seekers back into Mexico, and that it potentially violates the law in doing this because officials know that they're placing these migrants in harm's way. And so there are a number of advocates, lawyers, judges who said that Homeland Security officials could be violating U.S. law by doing this.
Sick kids, kids of service members abroad. Jack Beatty, what's next?
This is the bottom for inhumanity thus far for this administration. It's really just hard to believe.
All right, hold that thought. We're diving into the week that was, and you can join the conversation. What do you hear in former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis's critique of President Trump's leadership? With Karen Travers, Laura Barone Lopez, and Jack Beatty, I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. We're taking a look at the week's top news stories, and you can join the conversation. What's your reaction to the Oklahoma ruling against Johnson & Johnson over its role in the opioid crisis? How about the EPA's rollback on methane regulation? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Karen Travers. She's the ABC News White House correspondent, Laura Barone Lopez, national political reporter for Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Karen, we had a report from the Justice Department Inspector General this week that chastised James Comey, the former FBI director, for improperly releasing memos that documented his interactions with President Trump. Now, on the one hand, President Trump attacked him for the conclusion that Michael Horowitz reached. On the other hand, Comey's allies pointed out that he was disclosing information because he believed the president was trying to obstruct his investigation and wanted to do something about it. How do you think this nets out for the administration this week?
I think there's a little bit of something in here for everybody. If you support Comey and think what he did was right because of his concerns about some of the things that President Trump was saying to him in those conversations, you feel vindicated that he's not going to be prosecuted for these violations. He, of course, says these memos were personal, that they were his recollections after these meetings. If you think Comey was the worst FBI director who was out to get Trump, well, then the conclusions in this IG report certainly would help you with some back that up a bit. And you can say, see, Jim Comey was violating standards and that he should not have done this. Now, one big thing here, the president has said repeatedly over the past 2 years that Comey was leaking classified information. And that's not what this IG report says. So Comey jumped on that yesterday with a tweet saying that for everybody who had been slamming him for that, he would appreciate a bit of acknowledgement there. He's not going to get it from President Trump, that's for sure. But, John, I thought it was interesting this morning, the president, you know, he was so critical of Attorney General Jeff Sessions for everything he did at the Justice Department and what he did not do as the head of the Justice Department. He said today, though, that the fact that Comey's not being prosecuted shows how fair and reasonable Attorney General Bill Barr is. So interesting that Barr is not going to get any heat from the president. I think it shows how much the president just likes him over there.
Oh, I think he likes him plenty.
A lot.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Kathy on the line from Colchester, Vermont. Kathy? Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hello. How are you?
Good. Go right ahead.
I'm very pleased that Comey is not going to be prosecuted. I encourage everybody to read the actual report. But I just clenched my jaw when I think about what he might have been prosecuted for versus what is going on with this administration. And I'm very frustrated.
Kathy, thanks so much for your call. Jack Beatty, what's your perspective on this? Is Bill Barr showing forbearance by not prosecuting, or was there no case to begin with?
It sounds like there was no case since this was an inspector general report and since his integrity hasn't been challenged that I know of. But the whole thing had a kind of poetic justice about it, didn't it? I mean, here it is, a report saying we're not going to prosecute you, but you did something rash and arrogant and you broke the rules. And it's just the same position that that Comey gave in 2000, right around now in 2016 about Hillary Clinton. We're not going to prosecute her, but I am going to give her a stern lecture on her conduct. And here he is, the same thing now happening to him.
Laura, do you think that this is an event that registers with voters? Or now that we've had the Mueller report, we've had some congressional hearings with Mueller testifying, slow trickle of members, Democratic members coming out in favor of impeachment, but no action so far. Is the public tuned out from this story?
You know, I think that the vast majority of the public has not read the Mueller report. The vast majority of the public is not as tuned in as our
coverage. I'm pretty sure they won't read the Inspector General report.
Right, and I doubt that they'll read the Inspector General report. And so do I think that voters, in my experience and in my reporting out on the trail, are going to decide how they're going to vote based on what that IG report just came out with, which found that Comey did not leak classified information? No, I don't think that a voter is going to cast their ballot on that. I think that voters who are much more engaged now than I have seen them in the past on the campaign trail, and part of that is because of Trump, and a lot of them are holding certain Democrats' feet to the fire when it comes to impeachment because of the Russia investigation. And that's even in some swing districts. Those are districts that used to be red and turned towards Democrats in 2018. But as it pertains to this moment right now with the IG report and specifically with Comey, I don't expect that will impact that many people.
Now, another former administration official who was not fired, he quit, although the line may have been a little blurry there, is Jim Mattis, the former defense secretary. And he's come out this week saying that the nation needs to turn away from tribalism, offering some veiled critiques of President Trump and his leadership style. We had the a statement in or an assertion in Jeffrey Goldberg's piece in The Atlantic that people in the administration found the president to be of, as Jack indicated before, limited cognitive ability and dubious character. James Mattis hasn't done a straight-up attack on the president. Karen, how do you think the White House is processing the gradual emergence of Jim Mattis's voice?
I don't think we're going to see – now, I say this today. We'll see what happens. I would be surprised to see the president come out and attack Jim Mattis because he did respect him a lot when he was serving in his administration. Mattis says, you know, he was surprised that he got picked to be the defense secretary given how public he was with his views on NATO and other global alliances and given the president's views on those issues. But they obviously got to a point at the end of last year where the situation in Syria was the breaking point for Mattis. And he was candid about that in his letter when he resigned. And now he's coming out with this new book, which is why he's doing interviews now. I think it would be tricky for the president.
Isn't the president's respect for any person contingent on the last thing that person has said about him?
And loyalty to him, of course. Now, I think then that's why you see Mattis trying to thread the needle a bit here, saying in that interview with The Atlantic that he owes the president his silence, but also issuing a bit of a warning that that silence is not going to last forever. So I think there you have Mattis saying, I'm going to hold some of my strongest criticism back right now, which certainly would be something I think the administration will appreciate. Depending on how the president reacts then, as Jim Mattis does this rollout of his book and does more interviews, maybe that speeds up that timeline for how silent and when he no longer is.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Aaron on the line from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Aaron, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. So, you know, I listened to the things that Mattis had to say, and I think Mattis, being a true patriot, his message is consistent where we're going to put the country first, that we're going to put our allies first. I think that the message is a little vague and broad, but I think it's consistent with things like the Comey report, things like what the CIA director and the FBI director are still saying, that our democracy is still under attack. And I think that doesn't resonate well with the president because he still wants to make this about personal individuals, and he gets a lot of airtime attacking individuals. These directors and former directors, they're clearly stating that the United States and our allies is country first, and we've got to put country first. And I'm just curious to see how that's going to play out in the broader perspective in the media, that it's not about any one individual anymore. It's about protecting our democracy going forward and protecting our allies and not allowing hostile governments to interfere and interject and even, in other words, craft our foreign policies.
Aaron, thanks so much for your call. And I'm curious, too, Jack Beatty, do you think that Jim Mattis has sent a message that the American people will hear, or is it too muffled given the way in which he's speaking?
I think his reticence undercuts anything he's saying. I mean, the Jeffrey Goldberg's piece, you mentioned it in The Atlantic. At one point, he says, now he puts in all these negatives about Trump, and he said, now General Mattis didn't say any of this and isn't saying any of this. And he's, you know.
Though Jeffrey tried.
He did try. He did try. And I think that's going to be happening in all these interviews he has. People are going to be banging away and trying to get him to say something about Trump. And he's going to keep to his stiff upper lip military code. And there's an honor in that. It just that it seems a little just as Robert Mueller's similar reticence seemed ill-timed given the crisis in our democracy, or what many people think is a crisis in our democracy. So the general's military reticence is it perhaps is not helpful to the country's overall health.
Now, we had one significant development in the center of the country this week on the opioid crisis, and in particular, the responsibility of a major American pharmaceutical company. Here's Oklahoma Attorney General Mike Hunter reacting to the ruling against healthcare conglomerate Johnson & Johnson over its production of opioids.
What we showed during our 7-week trial and what Judge Bachman confirmed today is what we know now for certain. Johnson & Johnson was the kingpin behind the nation's ongoing opioid crisis.
Laura Barrón-López, that sounds like a big deal.
Yeah, it is. And that ruling, that decision by the judge, has the potential to impact a number of other lawsuits, not just against companies like Purdue, against, you know, other opioid manufacturers, because it could pressure these companies to settle as opposed to going fully through the courts. But again, you know, a day later, that is what we got word of, with Purdue deciding that they would like to settle. I don't believe that that's been finalized, and there has been pushback from some other states because they have individual other lawsuits of their own that they're bringing against Purdue related to the opioid crisis.
Laura, one of the strange things about this was after that settlement was or that judgment was issued, Johnson & Johnson's stock went up, which I found a little confounding.
That is, considering that the judge said that they conspired, that they fueled one of the largest public health crises in the country. You know, more than 400,000 people across the U.S. since 2000 have died as a result of the opioid epidemic.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Norma on the line from Norman, Oklahoma. Norma, welcome to the show.
Hi. Actually, I would like to counter what she just said with the people who have been lost in this drug war have been people that overdosed from black market products. We are affecting the patients with all of this. 2 years ago, our attorney general in Oklahoma got $1.6 million to find an answer to the opiate crisis. Well, you can't find an answer unless you can address the black market. But they did. They tried. They threatened doctors and made them come down on the daily dosages of these patients. I lost a dear friend who killed herself, and I know there are many others who killed themselves because they no longer had the amount of pain relief they needed to go to their lives every day and their jobs every day. And everything that's happening right now is only going to affect the legal patients.
Norma, thanks for that perspective. Obviously, this is an extremely complicated issue that involves, as you indicated, both legal prescription as well as the under the table black market exchange of these drugs. And the solution has been pretty elusive. I want to turn to one other issue before we run out of time, and that is on Thursday, the Trump administration announced a rollback of regulations on methane emissions from oil and gas companies. Appearing on MSNBC, Timothy O'Connor of the Environmental Defense Fund condemned the rule change.
The Trump administration has made many questionable moves since they've come to office, and this one is probably one of the biggest head-scratchers. When environmentalists and major oil companies are on the same page, you really have to ask why we need this direction. About 25% of the man-made warming we're experiencing today is because of methane.
Karen Travers, is the administration confident that this rule change is going to benefit them and not turn into a political quagmire?
It's certainly going to become political, and it's going to head into the courts, too, like almost every administration policy, rule change, regulation that they've done on environmental issues. Advocacy groups had already been saying they were going to file suit. And we've seen that before with the Clean Power Act and other big changes the administration has made. You know, the details of this are pretty complicated, but I think the big thing for people to take away is this is yet another example of the Trump administration trying to undo, reverse something the Obama administration did on greenhouse gases. And the Trump administration is going to get criticized for favoring oil and gas companies. And, you know, we've seen this play out before. I think this is just the latest chapter in what's an ongoing story there.
Well, one of those steps they've taken is to try to undercut a settlement that automakers have reached with or want to reach with California on strict auto emissions. And the administration seems to be arguing that they know better than the car companies what's good for them.
That was striking to see, you know, kind of the strange bedfellows there when you saw some of the car companies in California, because they have already agreed to this. So, yeah, this was interesting to see how that played out. The administration saying we're going to plow ahead with what we want to do on this, though.
Laura, do you see environmental issues looming large in the 2020 campaign, or is it going to be more economic and culture wars?
Oh, they definitely loom large. I mean, Democrats wanted a whole climate change debate, and that's because of, you know, scientists are warning loud and clear that if dramatic action is not taken, there will be substantial consequences for the Earth in a matter of 10 to 15 years.
And that first climate forum will take place next week on CNN. That's all the time we have. Karen Travers, ABC News White House correspondent, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Laura Barrón López, national political reporter for Politico, thanks to you.
Thanks, John.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, have a great weekend.
Thank you, John.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.